So this is a talk about putting the ideas of quantum information into the undergraduate quantum mechanics curriculum. So in some sense, this is a talk about teaching and pedagogy. But on the other hand, I don't think that that's really something that we know how to do very well. So it is definitely sort of research, and I'm definitely going to report on an experiment. Which may or may not be successful, time will tell. And to start with, I have to tell you, this is really not a commercial for this book from Cambridge University Press. No, it really isn't a commercial. But because this is the work that I want to talk about, I'll inevitably talk a lot about the questions that we ask in writing this book. And the choices we made and why we made them. That's what this is all about. And I think that this book is not a uniquely good attempt at this. And I think that there are many other possible ways to do it. But this is the account of one such experiment. So the story starts in late 2005 when I get an email from Simon Kaplan, who's Cambridge University Press. Physical sciences editor, and he says, well, we've got this idea that's kicking around that somebody should write a new quantum mechanics textbook that takes into account all the new developments in quantum information and quantum computing, and I've sort of been shopping this idea around, and several people have mentioned that maybe you would be willing to do this. And I thought about it, and I asked my friend and collaborator, Mike Westmoreland, who's here with me. I said, Mike, you want to write a book? This sounds like fun. So we said yes. Now, Mike's reason for saying yes, according to Mike, is that he's a mathematician, you must understand. And so he's never actually had exactly a physics course in quantum mechanics. His formal training in quantum mechanics consists of two philosophy courses and a year-long course on spectral measure theory. And so all of which were very good and very helpful. But what this means is that he feels largely self-taught about this subject, and he's picked a lot of things up from just sort of listening in the quantum information community, which he's been a part of for 15 or 20 years. So that was his motivation for doing it. My motivation was to sort of hold myself accountable. And I have often said, tried to claim that the last decade and a half or two decades have really amounted to a kind of a revolutionary change in the way we look at physics, that we're much, much more concerned about the concept of information. The concept of information is permeating physics. It's providing all kinds of new ways of thinking and new insights, and this is a revolutionary change. And then I have sometimes added that we'll know the revolution has succeeded when this is the way we actually teach it. And having made such a claim, I decided that this would be an interesting experiment to try to make the revolution succeed, to be a good revolutionary join the propaganda arm or something. So given that we're going to write this book, we sort of decided there were two possible strategies. And the two possible strategies are, first, to write a book that is basically a standard development of quantum mechanics, making a really good standard development of quantum mechanics with lots of really interesting sidelights and everything, but enrich this with ideas and topics from quantum information and quantum computing and examples and problems and so on and take a kind of a standard framework for the subject and just fill it with quantum information ideas. And the other idea was just to throw out the way everybody has ever done it and start over and try to think of a new way to do it that would build in information ideas from day one. And so naturally, since this is an experiment, we chose the riskier and stranger one. In order to do this, that immediately suggested a bunch of questions that we needed to ask. For example, we needed to rethink the question of which ideas in quantum theory are the elementary ideas. the ones that should come first in your book. Which ideas in quantum theory are the advanced ideas that you should only get to after you've built the elementary ideas? I think that the standard answers to this may be wrong, or maybe at least not unique. And another thing is, what kind of problems are the easy problems that should show up early in the book, and which problems are the hard problems that you should put off till later in the book? It's a related question. So we wanted to figure out questions like this. So how do you go about doing this? Well, the first thing you need to do is you need to decide what it is that you're doing. And so let me explain two things that we're not doing. The first one, you can sort of see, is that our book is not equal to this book, for example. This is David Griffith's quantum mechanics book, which is the best-selling undergraduate quantum mechanics textbook in the United States, I believe, and is a very good book. It's easy to read. It's got a lot of great things, and it actually has some things that I don't think other books do very well, that he does quite well. And there's some problems with it, though. If I get a student who's just gone through a course taught out of Griffith's, and then I say, let's get together and do some quantum information research, I find that the student knows almost nothing that I want them to know. They know a lot of interesting stuff, but almost none of it is applicable to the problems that I'm working on. Griffiths has basically nothing at all about density operators. He has nothing about density operators, or positive operator measurements, or unitary time evolution. The word unitary does appear twice in the appendix on linear algebra. He doesn't even have unitary time evolution operators, much less completely positive maps. I mean, that's not even remotely close. Entropy is not there. There's nothing about quantum computing. There's nothing about NMR. I take it back. There is a problem that is tangentially connected to NMR. And so on. There, all these things that might be really good to know about to work in quantum information or quantum computing research are completely absent from Griffith's book. So the first motivation is to have a book that would prepare a student to learn some of these ideas in quantum information and quantum computing that would lay some of the background so that it wouldn't just be unfamiliar, completely unfamiliar. Now I want to tell you, Griffith has some kind of cool stuff. He's got this last chapter, an afterword. Not even called a real chapter, it's afterword. And it's got a few short sections on things like EPR paradox, Bell's theorem, the no-cloning theorem, the quantum Zeno effect, and Schrodinger's cat. And I call this the dessert model, which means you've had your nutritious, very important work in quantum theory, and now you've gotten to the end of the book, and so you can kick back and think about something kind of fun and not too serious. And all these interesting things are in there, and I don't want any dessert in our book, or maybe I want it to be all dessert. And when we got to looking at other quantum mechanics books, we realized something that we all really know, and that is that every quantum mechanics book out there is really about spectroscopy. The basic paradigm of all quantum mechanics is spectroscopy. That is to say, you've got energy levels, and you occasionally have transitions between energy levels, and that's what quantum mechanics is. You calculate those energy levels, and maybe you calculate some transition amplitudes. That's all quantum mechanics is. In your undergraduate course. No wonder these things aren't there, because they don't look much like this. Now, spectroscopy is really important, but it's not everything. So, what can we do? The other thing we realized that we weren't doing was that we weren't writing a book, really a quantum information textbook. This, of course, is Nielsen and Chang, a book we very much admire, but we decided we weren't going to try to write that book because we wanted to make this book a usable book in a real course. It's not just, wouldn't it be cool if the students knew this about quantum mechanics? It's, wouldn't it be a good thing just if everybody learned quantum mechanics in this way? it has to actually be usable as a course. And that means that it has to prepare the student not just for further work in quantum information and quantum computing, but other kinds of quantum stuff as well. They have to be able to think about spectroscopy. So that's an important thing. It's not just going to be a simple introduction to quantum information. It's going to be a quantum mechanics textbook, but lots of information ideas are going to be there. And also that means that we can't assume any kind of exotic mathematical background for our students. Yeah, they've probably had linear algebra. Yeah, they've had some lower level undergraduate courses probably. But nothing nothing too exotic. And also, the book had better address the standard quantum mechanics topics in a useful way. Hopefully, a really good way that everybody will be happy with. But in any case, a usable way. For one thing, if it doesn't, nobody's ever going to use it. And this is not going to help the revolution succeed if nobody ever uses it. There's one other important distinction between this book and this book, which we agreed with the editor very early in the process. And that is that our book should be only about two-thirds as long as the book by Mike and Ike. So that was a very important constraint. And we hit it just about on the money. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to tell you about something about the process we went through for designing the book and the things we thought about in sort of laying it out. And we really did actually lay it out. So this is what we did, actually. Oh, first of all, I got to tell you about the name. I should tell you about the name. Of course, the name is really meaningful. We could have called it Yet Another Introduction to Quantum Mechanics or something like that, but that didn't seem very fun. So we made up a name that we thought was kind of catchy. Of course, we want to each of these things in quantum processes, systems, and information is supposed to make you think of something. This is supposed to make you think about time evolution, including the time evolution of open systems that are interacting with their environment, more than you think about stationary states, energy eigenstates. You think about time-evolving states more than you think about energy eigenstates. And you want to think about the time evolution operator as being the primary object, and then the Hamiltonian you get from that. That's an important relationship. But the time evolution operator is what we start with. Okay, what about systems? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to emphasize the isomorphisms between quantum systems. For example, the notion of a qubit is really a statement about isomorphism between quantum systems. It says if you have a quantum system with the dimension of the Hilbert space equal to 2, it's pretty much like every other quantum system whose Hilbert space has dimension equal to 2 in some profound way, that they all have some of all have similar things going on, that phenomena you see in one system, you might see in another system. So we wanted to emphasize that. And we also wanted to think a lot about composite systems, entanglement and so on. So that's another thing that systems are supposed to remind us of. And then information, of course, is we want to discuss the role of information. In fact, we want to introduce information ideas in the book before quantum ideas. We want to start out with information to really emphasize how important we think it is. Well, because this has a really nice acronym. In fact, originally it was called Quantum Systems Processes and Information, but that wasn't as good. So this was a really nice acronym, and we thought it was very clever and everything, and thought it was going to be great. We found out after the manuscript was completed and proofed, I think. Yeah, maybe that our editor had not noticed our cute acronym, but he thought it was okay. I don't think it was a terrible shock to him afterwards. Anyway, so that's why. That's the real reason. Okay, now, so how do we think about this book? So here's what we did. We started this way in January of of 2006. Okay, we got a bunch of index cards. And we wrote on one stack of index cards all the good standard quantum mechanics topics that a good book ought to have. We looked at a couple of the ones we liked, and we just wrote on these things what it has. Oh, this has the coherent states for oscillators, and this has and so on. So we wrote them down, and we put them on we had a whole stack of cards, and then we made another stack. And these are topics that were related to quantum information and quantum computing that would be fun to include in a book that we'd like to talk about, that we thought were topics that were interesting and maybe had some enlightenment to give, or would suggest some fun problems, or just fun topics. This is what we're gratifying ourselves with this stack. Okay, and then we shuffled the decks together and we laid them out on a big table. And then we stared at it for a while. And then we rearranged the cards. We stared at that rearrangement for a while. And we rearranged the cards again. And we did this a lot. And tried to find different ways to arrange these topics in an order that made sense and in a grouping that made sense. And, of course, we discovered, what you probably already figured out, we had to discard a few of the cards because they just didn't fit in. We'll talk about some of the discards later on. And after this, after you do this for a couple of weeks, maybe you find an outline that you're happy with. This will not be the outline of your final book, but it's you're happy at that time, so that's important. So, okay, so this is a game of cards. Now, what kinds of things did we want to include? Well, let me just tell you one criterion that we had, which I think is a good one, and that is we wanted plenty of strangeness in the book. We wanted our quantum textbook should include a lot of the interesting, weird quantum mechanics stuff that we all like, that are, you know, the reason we're in the business, because quantum mechanics is just so interesting. And the reason is, first of all, why should we leave out the good stuff? But secondly, all these strange things, we think, are strange because they're teaching us something about quantum theory. And the purpose of the book is to teach the students about quantum theory. And so we wanted to put in as many of these things as possible. And so here are things. I think all of these things were actually on cards on the list. And all of these things are actually in the book. So, you know, everything from the Elitzer-Weidman bomb detection problem, which we describe in one paragraph, and the following exercise is, if the previous paragraph is not strange and disturbing to you, reread it. And all kinds of interesting things. The fact that when you rotate a spin 1/2 particle by 2 pi, you get a minus 1 sign, and that has experimental consequences. Things like superdense coding and teleportation. I could talk about a lot of these things. And so we wanted to put as many of this kind of thing as possible, things that would cause the reader hopefully to say, wow, this is really interesting. I hadn't understood quantum mechanics before, but now I understand it better. Now, the idea here is that in addition to quantum information and quantum computing, we're interested in quantum foundation questions. I think that those subjects have a useful interaction. And so we wanted our textbook to spur interest in foundational issues, to invite the student to want to know more and to think about how quantum mechanics can do this really fun thing and what the structure of quantum mechanics means. But we also didn't want to get distracted by a lot of questions about interpretation. We think sort of the standard everyday workaday probabilistic interpretation of quantum mechanics is good enough for the textbook, and we also didn't want to tie the textbook to a particular attitude about interpretation of quantum mechanics. So without getting into extremely interesting but thorny questions of interpretation, we wanted to have a lot of really interesting conceptual challenges from quantum mechanics in our book. Now, so what's the result of our card game? What's the result of our card game? Well, it turned out that the book wound up with a forking structure, a structure that bifurcates. And we decided this was the best compromise, but it is a compromise. So let me sort of explain the forking structure. There is a basic theory. The first five chapters of the book form a basic core theory in which lots and lots of things get talked about once. And lots of ideas are introduced at one level or another. It begins talking about two-level systems of various types. And then we have a chapter where we develop the mathematics of Hilbert space a little bit more. We have a chapter where we talk about various things about measurement, including actually there's a little bit about quantum cryptography here and about the uncertainty relations. And then we have a chapter on time evolution. And so that's the basic theory. And from the basic theory, you can go two ways. The next section of the book is what you might call the extended theory. That talks about entanglement and all the interesting things you can do with entanglement. Well, actually, about 1% of the interesting things you can do with entanglement, but some of the interesting things, anyway. It talks about density operators. It talks about the time evolution of open systems. Then comes part three, which is the first part of the other fork. And that talks about wave functions and angular momentum, ladder systems. That's basically harmonic oscillators and systems containing many particles. Notice, you're well past page 200 before you write down a one-dimensional wave function. Before you do the particle in the box, you're about halfway through the book. Okay, so it's sort of a different notion about what comes next. The next thing that appears in the book is all this stuff about stationary states that occupies most of the time of most courses. Problems in one dimension, 3D central potentials, and some perturbation theory. And then finally, the last part of the book is the last part of the top fork, which is all about quantum computing and quantum information per se, and all kinds of things about that, and concludes with a discussion of error correction. Fairly elementary one. Okay. Notice that there are at least two different things you can do with this. You could actually just follow the lower track entirely. This could be what you do in the book. And you will introduce some information ideas here, but then you won't do much with them. You'll mostly have a slightly eccentric, but a course that covers really all the standard topics. Or, if you don't really care about this at all, you could actually just cover the top part, and you'd actually have a nice preparation for Neil Soto and Chang, for example. Or you could jump back and forth, and pick up a little bit here and a little bit there. So, for example, In the fall of 2006, I taught a bunch of students, about 18 students, in a quantum mechanics course out of an early, incomplete, very rough version of the first part of the book. And here was our approximate trajectory in that course. We did the basic theory. And then we talked a bit about entanglement and density operators, not as much as eventually came to be in the book. But then we jumped down and did some of these things, wave functions and angular momentum and oscillators and so on. And from that, we went on to 1D problems and 3D central potentials. This was pretty much our trajectory in that course. So it was enriched a little bit, and I was really happy about that because I did research with some of those students. But that was our route. We're not actually using this book as our textbook for the PSI course that I'm teaching at the moment. But naturally, since I've spent the last several years thinking about with Mike how to explain things in quantum mechanics, it's kind of related, and the problems are like kind of drawn from the book and things like that. So Here's the trajectory for the present course. We assume they already know a bunch of stuff. And we start out talking about time evolution operators, and we talked about angular momentum and rotation. We talked about path integrals. Had to add that. That's not in the book. Then we just spent this last week talking about the extended theory about entangled systems and density operators and the dynamics of open systems and so on. And now we've moved on and we're talking about quantum circuits right now, and doing a little bit of basic ideas of quantum computing. A completely different path, but out of the same material. And that's what we hope. That's what we hope. Because we want the book to be usable in many ways. Because then maybe it'll get used more. And then the revolutionary stuff, a lot of which is snuck into the basic theory, will begin to be the way people teach quantum theory. Okay. So what kinds of things do we have? Well, one of the things we realized right away is that many of the ideas of quantum information theory rely on knowing a lot of math and doing a lot of fairly sophisticated derivation. So it really wasn't going to be a success if we decided that the place we needed to start was the monotonicity of the relative entropy. That was just not going to fly as an undergraduate quantum mechanics text. So we decided that what we really needed was we needed to very early introduce a toolkit of very simple concepts. Simple ideas, simple results, but significant ideas. Okay? In fact, these results that we wanted to introduce early, they should have some characteristics. And this involved sort of thinking about what kinds of things could have these characteristics. For example, they should be elementary. We want to introduce them in those first five chapters as part of the basic theory, part of the basic equipment. So they can't require a lot of very sophisticated ways of thinking about the theory. They have to be very straightforward to state and very straightforward to derive. Secondly, they have to be useful. I mean, it's no good at all if you introduce a really cool idea and then it doesn't do anything. Then you said, well, that was all very nice, but I'm not really quite sure why it was there. You want the idea to come up over and over. You want it to be upgradable. Because you've introduced this really elementary idea with not very much mathematical machinery, but as you develop the machinery, you want to be able to take this idea and restate it in a more sophisticated form. And you want to be able to do that as you go. And finally, you want it to be significant. You want it to express something important about quantum information and quantum computing. Even if it doesn't say all of that important thing, you want it to point in that direction. You want it to point in that direction. You want it to signify something very important. Okay, so let me tell you about a couple of these. Here's one. This is the result that's proved in the section 4.1. Chapter 4, section 1 is devoted to laying the background and proving this result. It's what we call the basic decoding theorem. It's a totally obvious theorem. Nothing here is new, of course. It's like this. So if Alice and Bob, by the way, are introduced early to the book, Alice encodes n equally likely messages as states in a quantum system, and by states we mean pure states at this point. We don't have any other kinds of states. States in a quantum system with the dimension of its Hilbert space equal to D. And if Bob decodes this by performing a basic measurement, that is to say a measurement of a basis, some maybe non-degenerate observable, and that basic measurement may be on a larger Hilbert space, H might be a subspace of a larger Hilbert space, maybe part of a bigger world, that doesn't matter, and inferring the message from the result, so from his message result, he guesses which one we have, then Bob's probability of error is bounded by this. The probability of error is at least 1 minus b over n. Okay, and that's easy to prove. It's easy to prove. So what does this do? How does this satisfy our criteria for a toolkit idea? And it is elementary. We phrase it in terms of pure states, basic measurements, and only the most basic machinery of how that works is required to prove this theorem. On the other hand, it is useful. It lets us talk in a qualitative way about the fact that a quantum system only has a certain carrying capacity for information. But if you want to decode without error, it simply cannot be, no matter how you do it, I've got this backwards, I guess. It simply cannot be that D is bigger than N. No, N's bigger than D. Yep, I do have it backwards. It simply cannot be that, because if D is smaller than N, this will be a non-negative number and will have some probability of error. And it also comes up again when we talk about quantum key distribution, which is a few sections after this. We talk about quantum key distribution, and we talk about the challenges facing the eavesdropper. In the BB84 scheme, you have a qubit, dimension 2, but there are 4 possible states that are transmitted. And so nothing the eavesdropper can do can identify the, at least no basic measurement that she performs, can identify which of the 4 BB84 states is present with a probability of error less than a half. At least 50% error probability for the eavesdropper to find out the BB84 state. So this becomes a useful result right away. Yeah.
So when you prove this result, do you allow for the measurement to couple to an ancilla and so forth?
What we allow is the measurement might live in a larger Hilbert space, and that turns out to be all you need. And so by actually sneaking that in, it turns out that when we later talk about generalized measurements, we don't have to do anything more. It already has that built in. So that's very helpful. Okay, so is it upgradable? Yeah, you betcha. Once we have mixed states, we can upgrade it. Once we have positive operator measurements, we can upgrade it there. And finally, is it significant? Yeah, it is significant because it foreshadows a lot of really important stuff. For example, it foreshadows Holovo's theorem about information conveyed in classical information conveyed by a quantum mechanical channel. So this is a great example of something simple that is elementary to prove, useful, upgradable, and significant. Another example, and I don't want to spend much time on that, is the concept of entropy. We introduced the notion of entropy early. The first entropy expression, which is this top one, where it's the logarithm base 2 of the number of messages, possible messages, that's actually equation 1.2 in the book. And soon thereafter, about 1.4, is the Boltzmann expression for thermodynamic entropy, which we then qualitatively relate to that. And we use this for giving quantifying the amount of information in elementary circumstances. But then later on, when we prove the decoding theorem, then we sort of say, you know, in a certain sense, the log of the dimension of the Hilbert space is a kind of capacity, because you can't send more information than that with such a signal without error. It's an intuitively defined capacity, but we can begin to talk about the fact that quantum systems may have a finite information capacity, even though they have lots and lots and lots of states. And then later on, of course, in chapter 8, we define density operators, and so we can kind of define them. Here we don't have the full expression yet, but if we have a density operator that's uniform on a subspace, we can relate that to a quantum entropy by by analogy to the classical entropy. But then finally, in chapter 19, we talk all about the properties of entropy, classical and quantum entropy, and all about their information theoretic significance, and we continue that in chapter 20. So we have the full theory here, but a lot of the qualitative ideas have been planted earlier and have been used in discussions of the interpretation of results. Okay, another thing that we wanted to do in the book, besides having just having some ideas that we introduce early and we carry with us and use a lot, is we wanted to have ideas that themes that kind of recurred. We wanted to tell stories that reach from the beginning of the book to the end of the book. And as you go through the book, you could go through four or five chapters spread throughout the book and develop a whole idea, a whole set of ideas. And so here's an example, a simple example, and that's the idea of isomorphism between quantum systems. And of course, we will start out by talking about qubits. We talk about qubits, but we don't just talk about a qubit system has two states, and here are all the things about it. We actually develop the idea of a qubit in three different physical contexts. One, a photon in a two-beam interferometer, a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, or some kind of variation of that. The second one is a spin one-half particle that might go through a Stern-Gerlach apparatus. And finally, a two-level atom, which is a common idealization in physics, a two-level atom. And in each of these things, we introduce some aspect of quantum mechanics. In chapter 2, we more or less anticipate almost all of the basic theory in the context of these systems. They introduce a different aspect of quantum mechanics. So, for example, the photon in the interferometer tells us about amplitudes and interference and unitary time evolution. The different stages of the interferometer, beam splitters and phase shifters and stuff, produce unitary changes in the matrix of amplitudes. The spin one-half particle tells us that there are different bases for measurement make sense, just as much sense. So it gives us a kind of a motivation to seek a more basis independent way of thinking about it. And this is where we actually introduce tets and Brons. And the two-level atom, this is where we actually introduce the Schrodinger equation, and where we develop the idea of operators representing numerical observables. And that's in this system. Now, of course, since the systems are isomorphic, once we develop an idea in one system, we can apply it to the others and get more insight. Because all of the above have the same mathematical structure. And once we do this, after chapter 2, of course, whenever we want to explain something new, we can go back to the qubit example, because we discussed that in great detail, not simply as an abstract example or one of these guys, but all three of them, so that you can say, well, think about this as a qubit, and think about that qubit as if it were a photon in an interferometer, or think about the qubit like it was a two-level atom, and here's what's going on. And you can do that for time evolution, entanglement, mixed states, decay, and decoherence processes, and so on. So the qubits are the isomorphism of qubit systems is a recurring theme in the book. Here's another thing we did was sort of in parallel with not quite parallel, but in homage to qubit systems, we developed the abstract notion of a ladder system. Like a harmonic oscillator turns out to be a ladder system, if you think about its energy eigenstates. And you can talk about all kinds of things about like coherent states and so on. And once we introduce the ladder systems, they immediately become examples of all the things we've done up to then, like thermal states and open system evolution. There's a problem where they work out the behavior of the damped quantum harmonic oscillator. We think that's a good thing. I mean, they do the harmonic oscillator. They should do a damped one, you know, because they did that back when they were freshmen, you know. So they should do it again quantum mechanically. Then, of course, they show up again later. You know, when we're talking about central potentials, we do the 3D isotropic oscillator because it gives you a nice way of looking at the degeneracies of radially symmetric systems. And finally, but not finally in time, jumping back a little bit, in chapter 14, when we talk about many particle systems, after we talk about symmetric and anti-symmetric wave functions, we actually talk about the occupation number representation for a many particle system, a system of identical particles. And then it's very simple. The idea is very simple. You say, look, each one particle mode is, for fermions, it's a qubit. Occupation number 0 or 1, or maybe superposition thereof. And for bosons, it's a ladder system. The occupation numbers start at 0 and can go up to any integer. And by establishing this way of looking at it, we can immediately talk about the a lot of the identical particle effects in terms of the properties of these systems, because we've already developed these and we have all the mathematical structure at hand. Pretty straightforward. Okay. Another story that we tell a lot, we spend a lot of time on, is thermodynamics. I say we spend a lot of time. Maybe it's not a lot of time, but it's a lot of time compared to almost any other quantum mechanics book. Quantum mechanics books somehow don't talk about thermodynamics very much. And part of the reason is that when all you're thinking about are the stationary states of isolated systems, there isn't much thermodynamically going on. You might use the word adiabatic when you talk about slow changes in the Hamiltonian, but aside from that, there really isn't much thermodynamics going on. But we have a wider range of concepts available. So, in chapter 1, we introduce information and thermodynamic entropy. In chapter 8, we introduce canonical thermal density operators. In chapter 9, we talk about interaction with thermal reservoirs. We distinguish between work and heat. I mean, look, the change, a small change in the energy is sort of the rate of change times time. And it's easily separable into two parts, which are, in fact, work and heat. The part that's due to rho dot, that's heat. The part that's due to h dot, that's work. And given this distinction, you can immediately do a lot of those thermodynamics things that you did way back when, but you can give them a quantum foundation and you can show sort of where they come from. And so we talk about that there. But, of course, we're not done because we don't really know what entropy is at this point. So later on, when we know what entropy is, we can define all kinds of things like free energy. We can show, for example, that the work needed to prepare a particular state from the equilibrium state is the work done by that shift is less than or equal to minus the change in the free energy. That's kind of an interesting, very general sort of result we're able to get. And also, we're able eventually to come up with a statement about the thermodynamic cost of communication in the presence of a thermal reservoir. And you know, how much does it cost to create signals that can be distinguished properly? And we can establish this result on pretty general grounds. So we wind up getting a lot of mileage from thinking about thermodynamics. But it turns out that there was another story that we didn't expect. There was an unanticipated theme in the book, and it's the theme of what we call informational isolation. Okay, and it turned out to be actually the plot of the book. Our book has a plot. It's a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's got an exciting ending. Don't put it down before you get there. The end. The last page is where it really all pays off. It's not a surprise, though. I'm sorry. Anyway, so here we are writing chapter 1. And section 1 was about information and the notion of a bit of information and various concepts of information. And we defined information sort of informally to be the ability to distinguish reliably between possible alternatives. When you can distinguish reliably, you've got information, and when you can't, you don't. And then we started writing about quantum theory, and we wanted to introduce it at a nice low level so everybody's really very comfortable and everything. And we talked about it in terms of wave-particle duality in a two-slit experiment. We looked at probabilities and quantum amplitudes in the two-slit interference experiment. And right then, we were stuck, because we knew that the end of this chapter should be all about how these two ideas are related, and you can't really think about one without thinking about the other. We had to do that because otherwise, it would be like two books sort of interleaved. Okay, so we had to do this. This was in some ways a purely rhetorical thing. We wanted to find a way to just convince everybody that we weren't totally crazy at this point. And we sat there and said, let's try this. So we wrote about the idea of, what if you made a measurement of which slit the particle went through? Well, then the interference would go away. And a measurement, well, it doesn't have to be some observer. It could just be an automatic device making a record. And so we wound up saying something like this. We said, the quantum rule for adding probability amplitudes applies when the system is informationally isolated and produces no physical record anywhere in the universe about which possible intermediate alternative is realized. I say, clearly, you have to think about information to think about quantum theory, because the condition under which the superposition principle holds, the condition under which you get interference, is an information condition. It's not an isolation condition. The environment can apply all kinds of potentials and so on to the system, provided the system doesn't leave any traces, doesn't leave any footprints behind about what happened. It's informationally isolated. Oh, this is great. You know, they're going to buy it. They're absolutely going to buy it. And so then we went off to write the rest of the book. And over the next couple of years, we began to realize that, by the way, this was our slogan for this. Quantum mechanics is what happens when nobody is looking. Every book should have a slogan, I think. This is ours. Okay, so as we went along, though, we found that this same idea showed up everywhere. We kept referring to it. We kept invoking it. We kept developing it. We talked first about interference and unitary evolution. When we talked about qubits, well, under what circumstances are we going to expect to have this kind of evolution? Well, of course, it's when the photon passing through the interferometer is informationally isolated. When it bounces off the mirror, you can't tell it bounced off the mirror. It might have bounced off the other mirror. There's no record left behind. It came up again in quantum key distribution. The key thing was that if the transmission from Alice to Bob, if that system is informationally isolated, that means that the eavesdropper is shut out. It means the eavesdropper is shut out. And if the eavesdropper is not shut out, that will show up in a failure of interference somewhere. The no cloning theorem. That's all about the things being informationally isolated, as you will see in a minute. There's something we wound up proving called the isolation theorem. Thereby hangs a tail, so we'll come back to the blue guy. When we talk about heat and work, you know, if the system is informationally isolated and undergoes Hamiltonian evolution, you go back to those definitions of heat and work, no heat transfer. There's no heat transfer into an informationally isolated system. And we went back and did an actual analysis in chapter 10 of the idea, see, if the photon bounces off the mirror, it doesn't leave any record behind about whether it actually bounced off that mirror. So I said, well, suppose the mirror is movable. We did this analysis. It goes back to the Bohr-Einstein dialogue. We did this analysis of saying, well, what would have to be true about the mirror for the recoil of the mirror to be detectable? And it turns out that if the recoil of the mirror is detectable, then its location, then you have to know its momentum really well. And that means that its position is spread out enough that its location is uncertain enough that you won't get interference, because you won't have a definite beam path. And so by doing that analysis, we can show a sort of a trade-off between whether or not the mirror provides a record of whether the photon was there or not. It came up again. Golly, it came up again when we talked about just one particle's moving in one dimension. Because you know, when a particle's moving in an external potential, it is interacting with the outside world. It's the outside world that sets up the potential. But its evolution is unitary because it's informationally isolated. It's not dynamically isolated, but it is informationally isolated, the distinction we can make. It came up again when we talked about requirements for coherence in quantum computing, and especially talking about NMR systems. Well, the coherence lasts, you know, as long as we can regard the system as informationally isolated. And it came up in the last chapter as the major point about quantum error correction and quantum cryptographic security. When can you do quantum error correction? Turns out that's when you're informationally isolated. Well, we're working on all these things at once, of course. We're not writing the book in order. And Mike here I kept saying, you know, this informational isolation stuff is kind of interesting. We really ought to really nail that, find some place to really explain that completely and get it really worked out and everything. And so he was right. So about halfway through the book, we prove what we call the isolation theorem. It's an elementary theorem. But we think it has a lot of nice force. And the idea is this. We've got a system Q, and it's got some environment with a fixed initial state, and there's a unitary evolution of the entire thing. And the environment might be quite large, so the fact that it's unitary evolution might not be a very very exciting assumption. Of course, this is exactly the situation you might have if the evolution of Q was given by a trace-preserving completely positive linear map. You could always represent it in this way. So you have some kind of arbitrary open system evolution. You can always imagine that this is happening. Okay, so here's the story. The final state of the environment, not of Q, but of the environment, is this. You trace over Q. And we say that Q is informationally isolated if that final state of the environment is actually independent of the initial state of Q. Then by looking at the environment, you could never tell whether the input state of Q is this or that. That would mean that the environment makes no physical record of what the input state of Q was, even though they interact with each other. So that's what we mean by informationally isolated in this situation. And then the theorem is not too hard. I'll leave it as either an exercise, or you can watch the PSI quantum theory lecture from yesterday toward the end. Okay, and here's the theorem. The time evolution of Q by itself is unitary. That is to say, there's a V such that phi goes to phi V if and only if Q is informationally isolated. There's an equivalence between unitary evolution of Q by itself and informational isolation. That sort of captures this notion that we've been talking about since we were waving our hands about the two-slit experiment. Okay? That the key idea is informational isolation. That's the condition under which you'll have this linear evolution of the state vector. Yeah?
Is this sort of your way of saying what a measurement is?
I would say that if this condition held, then I couldn't really think that this was making a measurement in any way. Yeah, I'm defining when there isn't a measurement. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So this has all kinds of corollaries. Okay. For example, you may have recognized this machine. This is a machine which is the magic cloning machine, in which you have an arbitrary input state of system Q and another similar system Q prime in a standard state, and you feed it to the machine, and something happens, and maybe the machine changes, and I don't know what happens, but the advertisements tell me that out from the output end, I get two exact copies of the initial state, no matter what the initial state is. That's the proposed cloning machine. Now, there are various elementary proofs that the cloning machines are impossible, and we do give those proofs. But here's another one. The evolution of Q itself is that psi maps to psi. This is unitary. The identity is a unitary operator. Therefore, system Q is informationally isolated by the informational isolation theorem. Therefore, the rest of the world, M and Q prime, the final M Q prime state, has to be independent of psi. So if the machine does not change the state of Q, then not only does it not work as a cloning machine, the output of Q prime has to be completely independent of the input state of Q. Cloning machine is impossible. It's just a consequence of the isolation theorem. So we got pretty excited about this, and we thought this was this is a nice fact, because it really connects some very important physical principle in quantum mechanics to the idea of information. It does this from the outset. It happens again and again and again throughout the book. In half the chapters of the book, there's some discussion of this principle, and it's easy to prove, and it's sort of a unifying framework. And you know, I knew this. Okay, I knew this. But I don't think I really understood just how handy that is. Okay, so let me just take a couple of minutes to tell you about the about what's good and bad about what we did, and I will tell you some bad things, and I'll only tell you a few of the bad things, because I have some pride, and so here's some things that seem to work in the book, that seem to work in our project. The first thing is introducing quantum information and quantum computing ideas on day one. That seems to work. In fact, it makes the sense, and it gives a coherent story to this development of quantum mechanics. A story that's different from the story in other, but makes sense. Secondly, it seems to work to have a two-track structure. It makes it very flexible. It makes it very flexible, as you saw. Quite different trajectories through the material. It can form a larger or a smaller part of the quantum mechanics course that's taught. So that means that you can be just a little bit revolutionary. We like that because, you know, what we're trying to do is seduce our friends who teach quantum mechanics into using this book, or using a book that did something else like this. The fact that it's our book, you know, we're very happy about that. But what we really want is for them to join the revolution. But they can do it without sort of buying it wholesale and deciding to sort of throw out all the other things that they've ever done that they think are important. No, you can do those too, or you can do as many of those as you want to, but still include some of these ideas. I think another thing that works is the emphasis on time-dependent states and phenomena. I cannot tell you how many undergraduates have the impression that quantum mechanics is all about things that just don't change with time. That in quantum mechanics, it's all statics. Because the only thing they've ever calculated are the energy eigenstates. The only Schrodinger equation they've really worked with is the time-independent Schrodinger equation. Including mixed states, positive operator measurements, open system evolution, these work. And one of the reasons they work is that there are lots of new phenomena to describe and lots of new problems to solve. So it isn't just that we do some really interesting hard math that's very obscure and then you can't do anything with it. You can work interesting problems. You can answer interesting questions. The inclusion of non-standard topics, I think that works. I think, in fact, some of these should be standard topics. I think everybody needs to see entanglement. I think everybody needs to see the Lindblad equation. Now, that's kind of controversial, because the Lindblad equation is almost never exactly true. But it's often a good effective description of an open system's evolution. And so that gives you lots of interesting insight by applying it. And NMR. NMR is a really great laboratory for all kinds of quantum mechanical effects. And it's not present in almost any quantum mechanics book. It should be taught. It's a basic application of almost all the theory. And I think that the emphasis on thermodynamics also works. I think quantum mechanics has lots of important connections to other fields of physics, and we should point those out. And we shouldn't just say, oh, it's connected to classical mechanics, because here's Ehrenfest theorem or something. We should be broader minded. Now, okay, here's some things that seem to need work. We need more good problems. This is kind of a never-ending quest, of course, in a book. We can't just sort of ransack other quantum mechanics books and steal their good ones, because we're coming up with different things that we want to ask about. So, in the end of the chapter, problems are important, because when you get to the end of the chapter problems, you find out all the cool things you can now do and understand. Okay? They're important validation that what you're learning is good stuff. So we need a lot more tractable, significant, non-abstract examples. We can always say, oh, suppose you have a Hilbert space of dimension 4, and here are the Krauss operators for the open system evolution, and answer this question. But where does that come from? We want physically motivated examples. Another thing that needs work is the two tracks are a little too independent. That is to say, we think that the two tracks should talk to each other a lot more, that developments in one track should immediately suggest examples and applications from the other track. There's one place where this works really well. When we introduce the harmonic oscillator, we can immediately do a lot of really great open system evolution stuff with the harmonic oscillator and think about thermal states of the oscillator and all kinds of stuff like that. But aside from that, we don't really have very good communication between the tracks, very good. They don't enrich each other very well. And we think we could do that without making them too dependent on each other. And finally, there are a lot of missing topics. There are a lot of things that really ought to be in this book, we really wanted to be in this book, and aren't in the book. And some of it was that we just put in what we could and didn't have room for the other things. And some of it was that I just don't think we quite found the way of telling the story clearly enough. And so there were a couple of partial chapters that we wrote that just aren't there. So here's some examples of things that should be in the book. Path integrals should be in the book. I decided that after I taught path integrals now, and the PSI students said, that kind of fits in really well with all this other stuff. It should be in there. It isn't. Sorry, some other book I have to have that. The book ought to have a lot more quantum optics than it does, because quantum optics is another really great place for making all these ideas work. The book should have something about local operations and classical communications as things to transform entanglement, a fundamental idea in quantum information. We don't touch it. It should talk about Maxwell's demon. If we're going to talk about information, we're going to talk about thermodynamics. We should talk about Maxwell's demon. We don't at all. Grover's algorithm should be in it. Grover's algorithm is one of the great simple algorithms in quantum computing. It gives you an amazing result. It's not too advanced, but it's not in the book. See, I'm confessing all these things that need work in this book. And I guess this is justification for the second edition, though the concept kind of frightens me. State tomography, be kind of a cool thing to talk about how you can reconstruct the state from the results of measurements. That would be a very cool thing to talk about, very much in keeping with the spirit of the book. It's not in there. And we had actually planned an entire last chapter, the capstone chapter, on just discussing several alternate formulations of quantum mechanics, thinking about quantum mechanics in terms of Wigner functions, thinking about quantum mechanics, you know, in terms of this or in terms of that. Talk about different ways of looking at the structure of quantum mechanics as a way of sort of explaining that that we've provided, we've talked about the theory in a very particular context, but there are different ways of looking at that same mathematical context. We actually had a chapter planned, and we just decided that to keep it under two-thirds as long as Nielsen and Chang, we just couldn't put it in. So here's a short list of things that are missing. I think that you could make this list much longer. It's just an experiment, and not everything that could have happened good did. So anyway, I want to thank a lot of people who had something to do with the book. A lot of people we talked to about the book, including four of them who provided very generous blurbs for the back. There are several people who were, I don't know if I call them test pilots. That sounded better than test subjects or something else. And a bunch of folks at Cambridge University Press who helped us out a lot. I guess the traditional thing is to say that none of the people on this page bears any responsibility for anything wrong with the book. And it's probably strictly true, although I think Richard missed a couple of typos. So, all right. I know we missed a couple of typos too. So he caught a lot more than we did. So anyway, so that's all I have to say. Thanks much. Yeah, Tibra. That's a really good question, and the answer is no, and it should. I think that's one of those places where the two tracks ought to talk to each other. And at the moment, that's a place where they don't. So I think that there's opportunity to enrich this connection a lot better. That's an excellent suggestion. I agree, and it doesn't. So, yeah. I told you this wasn't a commercial for the book. See? Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. Yes. So for example, we didn't have that alternate thing, the alternate formulation of the quantum mechanics. But the Wigner distribution is a problem in chapter 10. So we did kind of mine those things for problems that we could put in front of the students. And there may be some additional ones. I think there are probably a couple that would be good. But yeah, we thought of that. Good idea. Sure.
Have you thought of or have you developed any sort of quantum mechanics concept inventory that would help you test whether this type of instruction to quantum mechanics gives a better conceptual understanding than the generic?
Yeah, this is kind of concept inventory things to assess whether your teaching strategy is doing what you intend it to do. Those are kind of useful things. They're not my thing, but I know people who do this. I'm a little worried about putting something like that together because I think that my concept inventory would be highly biased toward this way of thinking about quantum mechanics. And what I would establish was the thing I already know, that if I tell them this stuff, they'll understand this stuff a lot better. So I really don't have any feeling for that. A question, but I don't have I may be exactly the wrong people to undertake this. Bill.
Unfortunately, the people who do things like that have very strong biases in the other way. Mm-hmm. At UBC, I taught it was a second year, so that would have been sophomore,
right.
Introduction to special relativity and quantum mechanics. And I decided very strongly I wanted to go the sort of basically Heisenberg, spin two systems, operator, maybe have a little bit of wave functions in there, but the amount of time I had, which was 6 weeks, you really don't have time to go into that. So the direction was much more going through the spin 2 route.
Mm-hmm.
After I taught it for 3 years, I was retired from that course. In part, Carl Wyman, who came to UBC, who's
sure, of course, that would be right up his alley to teach
a strong. He felt that the only way to teach quantum mechanics was the very traditional Schrödinger equation, etc.
Oh, you gotta be kidding! No, I think, but that course would be one that he would be interested in.
He was certainly interested in the course. And he built all these little things which have waves traveling to barriers and bouncing off barriers and this kind of stuff. You know, just all the very classical standard type of stuff. So actually getting your department to be willing to do it, well, to some extent with me, they didn't have a choice. They decided to let me teach it, and that was what they got.
I have three advantages in that regard. One is I have a very small department. And so the law of small numbers is with me. I happen to have, this is the second point, I happen to have a lot of very tolerant people in the department, and so they're happy to for me to experiment with one of our essential courses. And also related to that, I'm now the senior most member of my department, and everyone else is there I hire. I think I was chair of the search committee for everyone who was there, and so it's working out beautifully. I know, but I think they're pretty tolerant, and so I think that means that I've had the ability to do a couple of experiments this way. I think Ian Durham at St. Anselm is in the same situation. That some of the smaller undergraduate departments are places where we can try some of these ideas, and if they don't work, that's okay. But if they do work, maybe the word will get out eventually. I'm hoping.
Right. No, I mean, all I was saying was that in a sense you have a very uphill role. Even the people who are supposed to be there trying to figure out what is the best way of teaching this.
It's the life of a revolutionary, Bill.
Strong.
That's right.
Prejudices.
It's that's okay, because actually most new ideas are bad. You know, so a certain conservatism I am sympathetic with, except in this case. So, yeah.
How much did you find you had to go over, say, classical information, classical computing? I know a lot of physics curricula don't always expose to even the classical ideas, so saying, here's how it works in the quantum case, and look, it's different.
Right. In fact, the students have been exposed to no information theory whatsoever before this course. And so you are explaining classical ideas along the way. And that's why I think that the approach is to find a subset of ideas, a reduced instruction set of information theory ideas to begin with, and milk those for all they're worth. And then later on, in one of those chapters you might not get to, but maybe you'll get to in the advanced course in the second semester, or you'll get to with your research student who's preparing to do a project with you, you can develop the information theory much more richly. I think that's one of the reasons why we decided not to develop a lot of information theory, just some ideas that we could then make use of as we went along. Yes.
Now, you gave one example how you went through that course. For which year was it?
Well, there were two examples in some sense. Let's see. That was up here. One of them was the fall of 2006, and so this was actually, you have to understand that we signed the contract in May, and this class began in August. Okay, and so things were only a few chapters were finished, and we were writing very fast during the semester to get it into the hands. You know, all of the students had 3-ring binders they could stick the book in. You know how this works. You've all done this, and that was very early, and we used that as to tell us what worked and what didn't work in those parts of the course.
Was it a senior course?
A senior course. Juniors and seniors were in it, it was a lot of really good students too. So it was a very strong class, and that meant that they were a bit more fault tolerant, I think. And that was a good thing too. And I had them for the second semester course, which is an applied quantum mechanics, atomic and nuclear physics course. And so I had some way of sort of assessing whether they were getting the basics of quantum mechanics. So I switched to a different book for that. And my assessment was that they were able to switch into a fairly standard advanced quantum mechanics textbook to do their atomic physics. And so that worked pretty well. Another person who's tried this book a good deal is Ian Durham at St. Anselm. I can't really tell you his trajectory through the book. I wish I should have contacted him. Which sections he's done. But then, of course, this fall, in the 3-week intensive course, we're doing a very different set of the book.
Yeah, but see, that's very graduate level, right?
That is what?
That's graduate level.
Yes, it is, except, of course, that it's their, I think for most of the students, it's entirely their first introduction to, for example, these ideas. For most of the students, it's their first encounter with it. So it's not like they're reviewing. It's working pretty well.
That's the question.
Yeah, sure.
I was wondering, is there a narrative in your book about how quantum theory differs from classical theories?
Several such narratives. For example, I don't think we put all of our comments on that in one place. But for example, here, one of the discussions we have is the discussion, once we introduce wave functions, why you shouldn't think of the wave function like sound waves. Okay? How is that wave function different from a sound wave? And we have a discussion of more than one reason why it really can't be interpreted that way. You know, for one thing, if you have, you know, a wave function that's got sort of two components going in opposite directions, they don't interact independently with a detector. You only detect it over here and not over here, or over here and not over there. They're parts of the same wave function, rather than a sound wave, which would independently affect detectors locally. And another thing, of course, is that for more particles, the wave function is in configuration space, which is not like, it's not like it's just the same wave twice the amplitude or two different wave functions. So we talk about distinctions between quantum theory, quantum ideas, and classical ideas in a number of places, but I don't know, now that you mentioned, I don't think that we have an official position on this is how quantum mechanics differs from classical physics. We think it differs in a lot of ways, and so.
Your first two items there are
yes, here, yeah, these are, well, this is pretty different, and some of these are pretty actually different, yeah. So I think actually this list is a good place where drawing the distinction between classical ideas and the quantum mechanical world is made repeatedly. Drawing that distinction is made repeatedly.
One comment that the one you did point out, the fact that size, you know, shouldn't be thought of as a sound wave, seems to me that that's an argument that has its home in sort of the old style. If in the new style where you're emphasizing information, it seems to me that the appropriate comparison would be to classical probability theory.
Indeed, and in that section, the comparison is made to classical probabilities, that in many ways acts more like a distribution. The different probabilities would be part of the same distribution. The distribution of a configuration of particles would live in configuration space, and so on. That's specified there. But then it says, then, of course, phenomena like interference and so on lets us know that the quantum wave function is not just a probability distribution. There's more to it. That's all part of that discussion. And the whole section called How Not to Think About Psi. It's the last section of chapter 10. And it's specifically to try to, at this point where we've done quantum theory for a long time now, we've now introduced wave functions, we're about to make all those conceptual problems of thinking of them as just regular waves. Let's stop and remember that this is quantum physics. I mentioned that as an example. Of course, that kind of thing crops up a lot because every time we have something weird going on, say, look, this is why it happens quantum mechanically. This is why we wouldn't expect it classically. All right, sorry to go on so long.
Yeah, so I suppose Ben is still around, so if you have more questions, there is.
Sure.
There is time to speak about that.